Good. Recap from last class, we were talking about OS services. Okay, so I basically said there are user abstractions the OS provides you, processes, address spaces, files, and whatnot. Okay, and these are made possible by various different services, all of which we will study in detail in this course. So at this point, it's not required that you understand what these all what services mean. And then the other thing to keep in mind is all of this, each service requires some support at the hardware level. So when we actually look at some of them in more detail, we'll try to understand how those, how a particular piece of hardware supports that service. Okay, but that's something to keep in mind, a specific hardware to provide or support specific OS services. Okay. What we did also last time, if you remember, or that was yesterday, was to define what a process is, and we will now actually look at that in a lot more detail today. Okay. The other thing we looked at were OS organization. Okay. We said there are different ways to write any large piece of software, including the OS kernel. Yeah, and we looked at four different organizations: monolithic, layered, microkernel, and modular. Yeah, so those are the four that you need to keep in mind. So what we are going to do today is focus on process management. Yes, question.
I have a question. I know this is meant to be working with before class, but I'm getting married 5 minutes ago. Is it possible that you could?
Yes, I actually, it is on the thing, but I forgot to save the edit to the HTML page, so it's not showing. That was my error. Usually it will always be up there. Today I was just in a rush to come down here, so I haven't actually, so the new page isn't saved to the disk, so that's why it doesn't show. Okay. It's an error actually. But it will be up right after class. Okay, so let me continue. So what we are going to do is talk about process management, we'll revisit the definition of a process, we'll look at what OS, the kernel needs to do to keep track of all the processes in the system, we'll look at different states that a process can be in, we'll talk a little bit about process creation, process communication will differ because it's a short class. This we will talk next time. Okay, so let's start with the definition. Okay, I mentioned this last time. Process is essentially a program in execution. Okay, so we said that you have a program that's a piece of code that is in a file. When you run that program, a process is created. Okay, so that's the execution context of a program. So typically we assume processes execute sequentially one instruction at a time. Okay. That's how code for the process executes. And then the process state will consist of all of these things. It consists of the code for the program, that's the assembly instructions or machine code. It contains the data for the program, global variables, the heap and so on. It consists of the stack, okay. Several registers, okay. Some of the key ones are the program counter, the heap pointer, the stack pointer, frame pointer, these are all the registers. So the state of the registers are also part of this process. Okay. And then there are a set of resources. Okay. This could be files that are currently opened by the program, any network sockets or any network communication, network endpoints that are currently open and so on. And then there is the state of the process itself. What is the process doing right now? Okay. There are various things it could be doing, and we'll talk about them in the next few slides. But collectively, all of this information, okay, is what is called as process state. Okay, and it's the job of the kernel to track the state of each process. So it knows what every process is doing at any given time. Okay, so it needs to keep track of all of these things for each process in the system. Clear? Yes? No? Okay, good. So here is an example. A very simple example, small piece of C code, equivalent representation as a process. This is a program. Okay, this is something you write. You compile it, you generate machine code. Okay? And when the program is actually running, when you start executing, it becomes a process. This is a typical layout. I showed this last time, two classes back. There is a text segment which consists of the code for the program. That's the code. Clearly, that's not what the text segment will contain. It will contain assembly instructions that are equivalent to this. I'm just showing source code here for simplicity. Okay, but assume that that's the text segment. It contains the code. This is the stack. Okay, the stack contains local variables for each of the functions. Okay, here, you start at the main function. You have variable A. This, you have some space for A in the stack. When you call X, you have a new stack frame, it can basically keeps track of the local variables in X and so on. And the stack grows upwards. Okay? If you do any dynamic memory allocation, if you do new in Java, or you do malloc in C or C++, all of those pieces of memory are allocated in the heap. Heap grows downwards. Okay? So these are the three key segments. Okay? That is basically the text segment, the stack segment, and the heap segment for the process. That's the memory layout. Here are some key registers. The program counter points to the current statement that is, or the instruction that is being executed. So this says that currently the program is actually executing this state. The stack pointer basically keeps track of where the stack ends. Okay, that's the stack pointer. The heap pointer keeps track of where the heap ends and so on. And there are several other registers that you could have. So all of this, the layout, the values of the register, etc., all of them are part of the process state. Okay. So now what are the, so I mentioned that there are different states of any that you could have for any process. What could they be? Yeah, typically, any process could be in one of those four, rather five states that are shown in the picture. And the states are new, ready, running, waiting, and terminated, also shown here. Okay. And some of the names should be explanatory. When you start a new process, it always starts in the new state. A new state basically says the process has been created. The OS is currently setting things up for the process. The process cannot actually start running until the OS is done with whatever bookkeeping it needs to do to start a new process. So whenever you, let's say, double click on an icon, a process will start up. It will be in the new state, and the OS will do things like load the code for the program into memory and all of those things. Okay? Once the process has been loaded into memory, okay, at that point it is ready to execute. Okay? So then it moves to the ready state. Okay, any process that's in the ready state essentially says that it is actually ready to run. Okay, it's not yet running, but any time it is given time on the CPU, it can start executing. Okay, that is the ready state. So saying that the ready to run but waiting for the CPU. Okay, at some point the OS kernel, because there are several processes, all of which may be ready to run. But only one process can actually run at any given time because you might have only one processor. Okay, if you have a dual core machine, at most two processes can run at any given time and so on. Okay, so of all the set of ready processes, only a small subset can actually be running at any given time. Okay, so the OS has to make the decision of which process gets to run next from all of the processes. Okay, this is called scheduling, something we'll study next time. But let's assume that this process eventually gets chosen to run from the CPU. At that point, it actually starts executing and it goes to the running state. A process that's in the running state is actually executing on the CPU. Okay? Now, while it's running, it might actually do I/O. It might try to print something to the screen. It might try to read something from a file. It might try to send off a network request. All of those things cause the process to go into waiting state. Because in a waiting state, the process has sent off some I/O requests and is waiting for that I/O to complete. Okay, so it's essentially cannot execute until the I/O finishes. Okay, so then you will be in the wait state. Assume that the I/O finishes after some time. At that point, you will go back to the ready state, which signals to the OS saying that the I/O has finished. At this point, the process can resume execution. Okay. So you'll basically cycle between these states. Okay, ready, running, waiting. Yeah, and then eventually your program will, or process will finish. Okay, at that point you'll go into the terminate state. Is that clear? Yes.
Is IPC considered IO as well?
IPC considered IO, yes. Okay. Synchronization, inter-process communication, disk request. Anything that basically requires some time for something else to finish that request will cause you to go to wait state. Any questions on this? Yes.
What about like ready to run after ready?
Yeah. Good question. What about, so there are arrows here which I didn't actually mention. The arrows show transitions. Okay, that says from what state can you go to what other state. Okay, so you will see that there's an arrow from ready to running and running to ready. Yeah. So basically, it's clear why you have an arrow from ready to running. Whenever you are in the ready state, the kernel chooses this process to for execution, it will transition to the running state. Why would it go back from running to ready? Why is there a reverse arrow?
Giving another process time on CPU.
So the OS has to do something called scheduling, because there are a number of processes, each of them gets a small amount of time to run, and you cycle through all of these processes. This is called scheduling. Now once you are chosen for execution, doesn't mean you are going to get unlimited time. In fact, you will get a finite time called a quantum or a time slot. You get to run through the duration of your time slot. If your time slot expires, you have to voluntarily give up the CPU, saying it's time for something else to run. You used up your time. So at that point, you'll go back to from running to ready. Okay, this is the case where you used up your entire quantum, didn't do any I/O. Maybe you are in a loop just doing computation, your time slot expired. So you could potentially continue to run, but the OS basically says it's time for something else to run. So you will make a reverse transition, you'll wait for your turn again. Yes, question.
So does each process have like a minimum amount of time that it requires to do something? Like what if it just gets cut off in between?
Okay, so does each process get us some amount of time, what if it gets cut off? So typically the way scheduling works, so what you're asking is what should be the time slot, duration of the time slot. The way scheduling works is whenever you get to run, you'll be given a certain amount of time. That time is chosen by the OS kernel based on a variety of different factors that we'll study. But typically in Linux, it's around 200 milliseconds. So in other operating systems, it could be as small as 10 milliseconds. It doesn't matter if you have more things to do. If your time slot expires, you are cut off. You have to wait until it's your turn again. Okay, so that's the way scheduling works. So you could be in the middle of doing some important computation in a loop. If your time slot expires, you have to give up the CPU. Okay? There are only very special cases where you are actually allowed to continue beyond. We'll look at that when you come to synchronization, where that correctness is affected. Typically, just because you give up the CPU doesn't impact the correctness of the program. It just slows the program down. But the program will continue to do when it resumes execution. Okay, so it doesn't impact correctness, it just impacts speed.
So if you finish before your time slot's over, will the next process be able to finish your time slot, or will it wait till the next time slot?
Right. So if you finish before your time slot expires, what happens? So there are two reasons why you would actually stop before your time slot expires. One is you do I/O. Suppose you are given the CPU, the next instruction is I/O instruction. Immediately your time slot ends because you have got to go to the waiting state. The CPU is idle at this point, so the rest of the time, basically a new time slot begins, something else gets to run. Okay, so you don't waste the time slot because this process cannot continue, execution is blocked. The other thing is you actually terminate in the middle of your time slot. Even in that case, your time slot expires. And then something else gets to run, a new time slot will be. So this time slot only gives you an upper bound on how long this process can run. Okay, but there's no lower bound. It can give up the CPU by doing I/O at any point. Process can also end at any point. At that point, the time slot will expire. Okay? So typically, there will be a variable. Actual time slices will vary depending on what this process does. Okay? So it should be clear now why there is a reverse arrow here. The one thing that you may not have realized is there is no arrow from waiting to running. Okay. So you will see that the only thing that you could do from waiting is go back to the ready state. So suppose you are running on the CPU, you did a print on the screen. Okay. Just print a string, you will go to waiting. Once that print finishes, you don't go back to running. Something else is running at this point. Okay. Because you gave up the CPU, the OS has chosen something else, so you have to wait for your turn again. That's why there is no arrow going back here. So the arrow actually takes you back to the ready state. Okay, that's something important to keep in mind. So why you cannot transition back from waiting directly to running. Okay, you go back to the ready and then you go to running. Okay, any more questions? Okay, so now here's a small program. It's a one-line program that basically starts. It prints hello, it's a C program, but it doesn't matter really if you don't know C. It just starts up, prints hello world, a string hello world, and it exits. Okay, so then the question is, when this process starts up, what sequence of states will it transition to? Okay, what are the states it will visit from start to finish? Okay, where will it start? And all everything starts in you. Okay? That should be clear. So once it has started, then what will it do? Okay, there's only one thing you can do from new. The OS is setting up the process. Once the process is ready, this thing will be ready. Okay, so the first state is new, the second state is ready. Okay, at some point, the OS will actually choose this process, schedule this process for execution. Okay, at that point, it will go to, it will start running, so it will go from ready to running. Okay, what's the first thing it does? And it starts executing.
So, IO request?
Sorry?
IO request.
IO request. So, first statement is print something to screen. IO request. So, the first thing it does as soon as it starts executing is it triggers an IO request. Okay, what will that do to the process?
Wait.
Yeah, so it was running, now it's doing IO, so it has to give up the CPU while this string is actually going to be printed onto the screen. Okay, so it will go from running to waiting. Okay, it will wait for some arbitrary amount of time until this command actually executes. Okay, hello world actually shows up on your screen. At that point, the IO has finished. At that point, we go from waiting to... Okay, from waiting, the only thing you can do is ready. We'll go back to ready. Okay. At some later point, again, the OS is going to choose this process for execution. We'll go back to running state, because now it's running. And then the next thing it does is exit. Okay, because there's nothing else to execute in this program, so you will go to terminate. So here is the sequence of states. So basically you start to know new, ready, running, wait, ready, running, terminated. Okay? So that's basically the sequence of states this process goes through. So given any arbitrary pseudo code like this, you should be able to list all the states that the process goes through. This is a very trivial program, but think of there was a loop, there's print, there's another print loop, you should be able to say this is what happens. Okay, so the exercise we just did is something what you will do more frequently in homeworks and maybe exams and all. Okay, so keep this in mind. Any questions on this? Yeah, that's a question.
How does it check for IO when it's in the waiting state?
How does the process check for IO in the wait state? So the process has actually sent off an IO request. It is in what is called a blocked state. It's basically waiting. Okay? The process is not going to check at this point. It's the job of the OS to tell the process when the IO finishes. Okay? Process will not do anything. It is not executing. It is just sitting there. Okay? It's resident in RAM and it's just basically waiting. It's in a queue just waiting for the IO to finish. When the IO actually finishes, the OS kernel will actually get an interrupt from the IO device. Okay, saying your IO has finished. The OS will know which process had triggered that IO. So it will know that this is the process that had initiated this IO request and that IO has now finished. At that point, the OS will know that this IO is done and it will actually move the process to the ready state. This is the OS that's moving it. The process doesn't do anything in this case. Okay, question.
So I guess I think the answer to this question is the IO is its own process and it's, you know, ready at the same time while it does the IO request.
Yes.
From the other process.
So the IO is actually, IO and CPU computation overlap. So what he is pointing out is IO is actually happening in the code for doing the IO is actually executing in the OS kernel independently of this process. So it is actually something that the OS is doing on behalf of the process. That's what a system call is, if you remember. This IO request will actually trigger a system call. The OS will actually execute the system call. Okay, so the OS is executing all of the code that is necessary to trigger that IO on behalf of the process. And the process doesn't do anything, the process is just sitting there. Yes.
So does that mean every time you type in a key, it keeps going down?
Yeah. Does that mean every time you type a key? That's exactly what happens. If you press a keystroke here, that causes an interrupt. Okay, that's an input rather than output. This was output. So the input flows slightly differently, but it's the same principle. You press a key, causes an interrupt. Okay, the keystroke arrives at the device driver. The device driver then basically tells the OS, here is a keystroke. Okay, then the OS says, what process is currently running? Okay, it will basically then deliver that keystroke to that process using this loop. Okay, because if you are actually waiting for an input, so suppose you prompt and say, type in something. Let's say you're typing in a password, the process that waiting for input is blocked. It is in the wait state, waiting for the user to type something. When you type something, that string or the text is delivered to the process, and then it will go back to the ready state. Same thing happens, is the short answer. Any other questions? So that's process execution states. The next thing we will talk a little about is all the data structures that the OS kernel needs to maintain. I mentioned that basically a state of the process contains of all of these things. It's the code, the data, the stack, program counters, and so on. The OS has to keep track of this information for every single process. Okay, it does this by maintaining some data structures in the kernel. That data structure is referred to as the process control block or the PCB. It's a key data structure that any OS kernel has to maintain. Okay, this is a data structure that allows it to keep track of every process in the system. Okay, so think of it as an array or a linked list. It's really a linked list, not an array. So there's one element for each process, and that element contains all of this information. Okay, so that's basically for every entry, every process, you have a variable that says what is the current state of the process. If it's in running, you say that will share running. If it's waiting, it'll show waiting, and so on. It'll show, keep track of the process ID, or the process number. It'll basically keep track of the word program counter, that's the value of the register, other registers, so on. There's memory management information, page tables, and so on, which we have not yet studied, but all of that is also in the process control block. And then lots of other things. User, list of open files, and there are a variety of other things like the priority of the process, IO status, is it waiting, is it blocked, and so on. Okay. So all of this information is kept track. Okay, so this activity monitor that I've been showing you, the list of all the processes, all that that program is doing is basically enumerating all the entries in the process control block. And then you basically get one entry per process. Yeah, so important data structure. It allows the OS to keep track of what each process is doing. Okay, that way it knows when a process is blocked, whether it's waiting, whether it's running, which one to choose, and so on. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so now there's one more thing to keep in mind. We'll go back to this picture here. So you can ask, how do you keep track of which process is in which state? Okay, there's one way to do it, is for every process you have this process control block that keeps track of the state. Okay. The way this, all of these things are maintained are multiple queues, one for each state in the system. So for the new state, there's a queue that keeps track of all the processes that are currently in the new state. For the ready state, there's another queue. It keeps track of all the PCB entries of processes that are in the ready state. Same is true of run. For all the processes in the run state, there's a run queue. Okay, that says these are all the processes that are currently running. There is another wait queue. Any process that's in waiting or blocked on IO, its PCB entry is stuck in the wait queue, and so on. Okay, so here's a picture that essentially shows you. Okay, so that's the ready queue. Okay, that's the PCB entry for process X, PCB entry for process LA, and so on. It's a doubly linked list. So you basically keep all the PCB entries of those processes that are ready in the ready queue. All the PCB entries of processes that are blocked on IO in the wait queue, and so on, and so forth. Okay. Yes, question.
So how, is it like FILO or is it LIFO or like what?
Okay, so it doesn't really matter in what order you put them there. Okay, so you can assume that it is last in, first out. It's a queue, so you put it at the end and take it out of detail, but that's really not important. What is important really is keeping track of what all your processes are doing. What these data structures allow you to do is quickly say, these are all the processes that are blocked. Okay, these are the processes that are ready. So if you have to now choose a process to run, all you need to do is look at the ready queue, pick one of those processes and actually schedule them for execution. You don't have to worry about these because they are blocked. Okay, so this allows you to keep track of what every process in your system is doing at any instant. Okay, so you'll have one queue for each state. as a new only shown two here, but there's one for new, one for ready, one for running, one for wait, one for terminated. Next question.
So does each process have its own PCB?
Yes, each process has its own PCB. This is the PCB of process K. All of these fields are exactly this, are these things. Okay, so there's one entry for every process. Okay, that is basically this. So you start a new process, it will have another, allocate another entry like this, and you'll have this is the process ID, this is the state of the process, that's the user of the process, I mean the owner of the process, and so on. Okay, all of those things are basically here in this. And there is one for each process. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so here is the question. So how long can the run queue be?
Yeah, I imagine there's hundreds. So, I mean, that's why I'm kind of confused about, like, why is it a linked list as opposed to, like, a hash table or something?
Okay, so the nature of the data structure shouldn't matter. I'm just showing a linked list. If you are writing a kernel, you can pick a hash table. It doesn't matter. You can pick a hash table, so it will be a wait hash, ready hash. The choice of the data structure is not really important here. What is important is that you have partitioned all the processes in the system into groups. Okay, there's one group that says these are all the processes that are waiting. Whether this information is stored as a hash table, as a singly linked list, doubly linked list, whether it's an array, it doesn't really matter. Okay, don't worry about the data structure. Okay, so you will pick something that is efficient, of course, meaning that insertion and deletion should be efficient. So if the hash table is the right thing, it could be hash table, it could be a B tree, it doesn't matter. Different operating systems will make different choices. Okay, this doesn't say every operating system has to implement a doubly linked list. Just a scenario. Okay, some do, others don't. Okay? But let's go back to the question I just asked. Let's say there are hundreds of processes in your system. Okay, then the question is how long can each of these queue be? In particular, how long can the run queue be? Yeah.
As large as your memory?
As large as your memory. It cannot really exceed size of memory, that is for sure. But how many elements? So what I'm asking is at any instant, how many elements can be in the run queue?
Just one. That's only one can be running at a time.
A single processor system, your run queue can have at most one element. Because only one process can run. So a dual core system, your run queue can have at most two elements. So the length of the run queue is limited by the number of cores in your system. So you cannot have more processes running at any given time than your number of cores. Okay. So run queue is typically the shortest queue in your system. Because you can only have as many entries as number of cores. The length of all other queues is unlimited. Okay. You can have arbitrary number of processes in the ready queue, you can have arbitrary number of processes in the wait queue, and so on. Okay. There's no limit. But on the run queue, there is a limit, and that limit is dictated by your hardware. If you have uniprocessor, unique single core system, run queue can have at most one entry. By definition, you can have only one process running. Okay, so that's the only process that will be in the run. So that's something to keep in mind. Any other questions about state queues here? Yes. What happens with the terminated queue? Why should there be a terminated queue? Whenever a process finishes, when this process finished, for instance, it moves to the terminated queue. Okay. So what is it? But the reason it is still there is the OS has to spend some time deallocating RAM for the process, freeing up the RAM, cleaning up the data structure, discarding its process control block entry, and so on. So since that takes a finite amount of time, you just move it into this terminated queue, and then you go and start deallocating memory, you start deleting stuff that it has done, and so on. Once that is done, then you basically throw it out. At that point, all traces of that process are gone. And there's nothing that tells you that process ever existed. Okay? It's exactly the opposite of what happens in the new. In the new, a process has been created, but there is stuff getting loaded into memory, is being allocated, you're loading text, and so on. Here, you're deallocating stuff. Okay? That's basically what is happening. Okay, next question.
the stuff like deallocating memory and like getting rid of processes and stuff, would those be processes by the OS, or is that something like a level above that's managed by the kernel?
So all of this stuff, deallocating, allocating, that's handled by the memory management subsystem. Okay, so it is run, it is code in the kernel that's doing all of that. Okay, so when we do memory management, we'll see how that works. So, but it is actually stuff that the kernel is doing, nothing about the kernel. It's all the responsibility of the OS. Okay, so that's state queues. Okay, the next concept we'll study is what is called a context switch. Yeah, that's basically, context switch is a process of stopping or suspending the currently executing process and starting a new process. Okay, it's basically switching from one process to another. It's switching the execution from one process to another. So basically, whenever, as I mentioned, that when a process gets to run, it gets a time slot. When its time slot ends, okay, the OS has to do some bookkeeping. It has to save the state of the current process, okay, save it all back into the PCB. It has to pick another process for execution from the ready queue, okay, and then it has to load the context of that process into registers and so on. All of this bookkeeping, okay, the process of the task of saving the state of the process, okay, picking a new process for execution, loading its state into registers and so on, all of this is called context. It's a bookkeeping stuff that needs to happen, and the process is referred to as a context. Okay, this incurs certain overheads, okay, because you are saving the state into the process control block, choosing, running the CPU scheduling policy or algorithm, picking another process, loading its state into register. It's going to take a finite amount of time. Okay? A day, hundreds of milliseconds, hundreds of microseconds, may take up to a millisecond. Okay? So during this time, there's nothing happening in the system. The OS is running, it's doing all this bookkeeping stuff. Okay? So this is referred to as a context switch. Now, the reason I said there are certain operating system pick different values of the time slot is that you have to amortize this bookkeeping overhead over the useful work that's happening in the system. Whenever a process is running, something useful is happening. Whenever the OS is running and doing context switch, nothing useful is happening. It's just doing bookkeeping, trying to figure out what to do next. Okay? So you want to amortize the overhead of a context switch over a reasonably large time slot. Your time slot is very small. Okay? You will do some bookkeeping, and then you will run another process for a very short time. And you will do some more bookkeeping. And you will run yet another process for a short time and so on. So you will spend a lot of cycles doing bookkeeping and relatively little time doing useful work. Okay? So if you have a large time slot on the other end, you will spend a short amount of time doing bookkeeping during a context switch, and then you will have a long time slot where you are actually running some process and doing some useful work. So then you amortize this wasted work that you are spending doing bookkeeping over some larger time. Here are your questions.
So did you say earlier that the quantum for a Linux system is 200 milliseconds or
yes.
Microseconds?
If it's 200 milliseconds, yes.
Then suppose you've got like a text editor running, and then in the background you have some, you know, computationally intensive process that's using lots of cycles. If you hit, you know, most of the time that text editor isn't going to do anything, but if you hit a character on keyboard A, doesn't the other process need to finish first? So that could take 200 milliseconds just for your A to appear on the screen. That seems like a really long time.
Yes. You're right. So the point, we'll revisit this issue when we do CPU scheduling. It's a good point. It may not be apparent why this is happening. So I did say that context switches could be in the order of tens of milliseconds or hundreds of milliseconds. Linux actually chooses a time slot that's on the larger side, okay, on the order of 200 milliseconds. So as is being rightly pointed out, if you have a computational job, let's say there's a job that's just doing loops, infinite loops, okay, and there's a text editor, if you press a keystroke on the editor, technically it should take up to 200 milliseconds for that character to appear on the screen because that job is running. It could take up to 200 milliseconds to give up its time slot and the editor to run. That is true. But the reason that does not happen is as soon as you press a keystroke, that raises an interrupt. Okay? As soon as the interrupt is raised, the OS will actually suspend the execution of this process temporarily. It will cause a trap. It will go into the interrupt service routine, process this interrupt, and then resume execution of the process. Which is why it looks like it is near instantaneous. because in typically that would not have been the case. What you are saying is absolutely true. If you are not raising any interrupt, then it will actually look like your system is not responsive. In this particular case, because this is I/O, you press the mouse click or do a keystroke, you will trigger an interrupt, which is why it doesn't look as slow. But otherwise, if you have two compute intensive jobs that are both running, they will take 200 millisecond slots, run one after another. So there will be a period of time where the other job is not making any progress. That is indeed the case. But if I/O bound and CPU bound, because I/O raises interrupts, you don't see this problem.
So then you're not guaranteed actually to get 200 milliseconds, even if that's your time quantum. You're just guaranteed to not get more than that.
That's what I said. It's an upper bound.
Okay.
You're guaranteed not to get more than that. Anything could happen. You could do I/O, give up the CPU. The OS could kick you off because an interrupt occurred. Okay, so a variety of things could happen. Any other questions? Yes.
So the operating system controls the time slots and kind of controls like who gets what time slots?
No.
If you only got one item running on the processor at a time, how does the operating system run?
How does the operating system run? The operating system runs between processes. So when a time slot finishes, okay, the OS takes over, it begins to run. That's what is happening during a context. When an interrupt is raised, you suspend the execution of the process, the kernel code begins to run. Okay, so the kernel always runs in between processes. That's the way to think. The kernel is not running at the same time a process is running. When a process is running, nothing else is running. The kernel is not running by definition.
Right, but if the say if it's during the point where the kernel is not running,
yep,
how does it tell the process that your 200 milliseconds is up?
Yes, good question. So question is, if the kernel is not running, how do you tell the process that you are 200 milliseconds up? Okay, that's why I said you need hardware support to do certain. So if you go back two classes ago, we said there's something called a timer. It's a hardware thing. Okay, so basically you start a clock. You set the timer to 200 milliseconds, it starts counting down. Okay? And then process starts executing, OS is not running at this point. When 200 milliseconds have elapsed, timer goes off. Okay? The timer goes off, that raises an interrupt. That's a hardware interrupt. Okay? Because this is happening in hardware, the timer can run. Timer is not a piece of software, it's a hardware clock that is counting down. So it can run while the process is executing. Okay? So timer goes off, that raises an interrupt. When an interrupt comes, the process will stop executing automatically. Suspend that, the OS starts. At that point, automatically, the OS has taken over, so nothing left to do. Okay, so you have to do things like that. But that's why I said you need hardware support to do things. If there is no support for timers, there's no way to force a process to give up the CPU. The process will continue execution forever. Until it finishes, the OS cannot even take it. So you need hardware features to do these things. There's some hand up here somewhere. Any other questions? Yes. Okay. So the thing to keep in mind is context switch is the task of saving the state of the process. So you're going to save whatever process's time slot has finished. You'll take its program counter, that's the register value, put it in the process control block. You'll take the stack pointer, put it in the process control block. You'll save everything. And then you will take the new process, the new PC. You take its register values, load them into the registers, point the program counter to the right place. At that point, that process will continue. So this bookkeeping is all wasted work. So you want to amortize it over the time slot. Okay, so that argues that the time slot should be as large as possible. Because if you have, let's say, you spend 1 millisecond in the context switch, you want to amortize that over some useful work. So pick a large time slot. But large time slot make the system less responsive, as was pointed out here. If you have competing applications, okay, if you have a very long time slot, nothing else gets to run until this time slot finishes. So if you want to be fair and you want to give time to every process, let's just pick the time slot to be as small as possible so you quickly cycle. Okay? So there are these conflicting trade-offs. You want better interactivity, you want smaller time slot. If you want to amortize the context switch overhead and get better efficiency, one longer time slot. Okay, so typically, you will pick a context switch time that will balance these two trade-offs. Okay, and different operating systems make different choices. Typical values run from anywhere from 1 to 10 milliseconds. Those are smaller context time slots. To Linux, which is 200 milliseconds. That's actually a long time slot. Yes, question.
So
Just going back a little bit, but you were saying that when you do I/O, like even like printing to the screen, that will put them in waiting. Does that do it immediately? What if the I/O is so quick that it happens within that 200 milliseconds? Does it, are they still automatically bumped to the back of the queue?
Yes, they're automatically bumped to the back. So as soon as you do I/O, you go into the wait queue. Doesn't matter how short or long the I/O request is. Could be near instantaneous, it could take a minute. Okay, it doesn't matter. When your I/O finishes, you will go back. Okay, now where you go back in the queue is a policy decision. This is what a scheduler can decide. If it says you are waiting for I/O, I'm going to put you in the front of the queue because you waited for long, that's the OS's decision. If you say no, you always go to the end of the queue, that's the decision again of OS decision. So that there is no set rule that you have to go to the end of the queue. It could be put in the front if you decide that I/O bound processes should get priority because they have not been doing anything, waiting there, waiting for the I/O to finish. Put them in the front, they'll run next.
I'm just thinking of, like, say, just do a simple print, right? You'd see it come out in spurts, but in those spurts, you'd see it print maybe 10 or 12 lines.
So these things basically take short amounts of time. So if you have a sequence of prints, what happens is you print something that takes a while. You go back to the ready. Typically, in most systems, there isn't anything else running. There may be one or two processes that are actually in the ready queue. Most of the processes by default actually are in the wait queue. Okay, so you may have a large number of processes. Most of them are not doing anything. They're just waiting for something. Okay, so if you actually go into the ready queue, chances are that you may be the only process or that you may be just, there may be only one or two processes ahead of you. So you actually get to run quickly. Now, if you do the same thing, have a sequence of print statements in one program and start an infinite loop process on the same machine and see the speed of your print statement, they will slow down significantly. Okay, but typically, if nothing else is running, you get this fast response. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So, last thing we'll do in the next 10-15 minutes is this notion of creating a process. So, we have looked at several independent concepts. Okay? So we looked at what's a process control block, execution states of a process. We looked at this notion of a context switch. Now the last thing we look at is how to create a new process in your system. So the way you create any process in the system is by telling the operating system to create a new process. And that is done by invoking a system call. And the name of the system call in Unix machines is fork. In Windows, it's called something called a create process. So anytime any process is created, this is basically done by calling fork. When you double click on some icon program, the GUI subsystem in your on your machine actually calls fork and starts executing the program you double clicked on. If you are on a terminal and you are on a shell prompt and you type a command, let's say you type ls, your shell actually calls fork, starts a new process and asks that process to execute ls. So no matter what happens, always there's a fork that creates a new process. There's no other way to create processes. A process may be created by the OS, that may be invoked by the user because you double click, started by a script, some command that you put on a command line. All of those things called fork. Okay? Now what is this fork? How does it work? So here is the interesting thing. So basically a fork is a system call that tells the process that is invoking fork, okay, not tells the process, tells the OS, that create a copy of the process that invoked fork. Okay, so a fork essentially is like, think of it, you basically made a mirror copy of that process. Okay. So let's say here is a process. Let's say it's process A. This could be your shell. In the terminal, it could be some arbitrary process. Okay, at some point here, it says fork. Okay, what this does is it basically triggers a system call, and what the OS has done is basically takes this memory dump, just creates an exact replica, just copies all of this content here, and you have a new process B, okay, which looks in all ways exactly identical. It has the same code, same data. Only thing it has is a different process ID. So this is now an independent process. This is the parent process, that's the child process. Okay, whenever you call for the child process is an exact mirror image of the parent process. It doesn't matter which process called for, you basically clone that process and you start create a new thing. That's how fork works. Now that doesn't tell you how, if you double click on the, let's say, Firefox, okay, your GUI subsystem has called fork. Okay, since the GUI subsystem called fork, the new process is actually a copy of the GUI subsystem, not a copy of Firefox. Is that clear what I just said? If you double click on an icon, or if you are in a shell and you type ls, your shell, which is bash, will call fork. The new process will actually be a copy of bash, not a copy of ls. Okay, then you have to ask, so now if you created a copy of the parent, but what you intended was to execute some other process, then what's the point? Why did you create this? Okay. So to now actually execute what you want to execute, there is actually a different system called exec. Okay. In exec, you basically specify the name of a program. This could be ls, it could be Firefox, and so on. So what the typically the sequence of events is the parent calls fork and creates a copy of the parent. In the child process, you actually call exec and you basically pass in the command that you are actually intended to execute. Okay? When you call exec, what actually happens is the OS will then take this memory image, will essentially scrub it. Okay? It will load this program into this memory region and then start executing. The way exec works, the way fork works is you make a mirror image. That's a new process that looks like exactly like the parent. The way exec works is you take a process, you essentially wipe out the whole contents, and then take the program that you have passed on as parameter to exec, load that program into that memory region and start executing that code. Okay, is that clear? Yes, question.
If it's actually copying over all those local variables, then does the context for which you call the process affect the speed of this one?
Repeat the question. If you copy everything, then what?
So if fork is copying all this data, does that mean that the context from which fork is called determine how fast the process is actually executed? At least initially, you know what I mean?
No, I don't think it matters at all. Because all that you've done is you've created a new process. At this point, this is a completely independent process. It has no bearing on what the parent did.
Okay, is it not copying like all the stack and the heap and all that?
Yes, it is copying everything. Cops, stack, heap, every single thing here, every bit here is actually appearing here.
Oh.
So if this is a large process, clearly forking that process will take more time than if this was a little process, because you have to take memory and create a.
Right, so it would take a little longer.
Yes. Yeah, work will take a little. That's what you are asking. Yes. Professor. Yes. Yes. It will take. There's an optimization which makes it independent of the size of the process, but let's not go into that right now. Assume that it will depend on the size of the plant. Okay, so now let's try to understand this a little better. Here's our actual program. Okay, your question is.
At what point does the child get his own PID?
Yes. What point is what happens is you call fork. Right? Fork tells the OS time to create a new process. Okay? It will allocate a new process control block. That process control block will have a different process ID. Okay? So within the OS knows that these are two distinct processes. So this will have a different process ID. That will have a different process ID. Okay? But as far as the process itself is concerned, it'll take this process, this memory image, it'll just clone it. So exact replica will appear here. So these two processes have the same code. Okay, if you did nothing beyond the fork, they will actually start executing the same code, okay, in both cases. Okay, so they will have different process ID. And that has actually happened at fork time itself. Okay, so here is a program that does fork. So the only two lines of code that are important here are these two. Okay, this line says fork. Okay, so what this does is then this will create an image of this process, okay, which has the same code. Okay, at this point, both of the parent and the child have just finished, exited fork. Okay, and then the next thing you will do is exec. Okay, exec says if you want to do ls, then you will basically, so in the child, you will execute ls. In the parent, you will not do that. Okay, so here you fork this child, the child will basically call Firefox via exec or call ls. So the child will start executing whatever you intended to start up the parent continues as is. If the parent was a shell prompt, it will continue to be bash. If it was a GUI subsystem, it will continue to be that. But the child process, once you are done exec, will the memory content will get replaced by this new program that you want to start up within the child. Okay, is that clear? Yes, no. Okay, there are lots of other subtle details that I haven't even gone into, but first let's try to understand if what is fork is clear. Okay, fork is a system call that creates a new process, and the new process is basically an image of the parent process, the process that called fork. Okay, what they should also tell you is that there is a parent-child relationship between every process in the system. Every process has a parent process. That's the process that started this process. If you yourself start new processes, you will have children. Okay, so there's a clear process hierarchy in your system. Yes, question.
Is there any way to tell, like, go back, like, find out which process was the parent of the child?
Oh, yes, that's what I was going to show. Oh, so the question is there any way to tell? Okay, so there's a command in Linux called ps-tree. It shows you all the processes in a tree format. Okay, so here is basically the process tree on this machine. It's long. So you basically start with init. Init always starts with process ID 0. That's what happens at boot time. Everything derives itself from init. So this is a child of init, and these are all demons. It doesn't matter. Okay, so this says this one has started here, this is started there, and so on. Let's dismiss one thing. Let's see. Okay. So this is the process tree. Okay. So this I logged in using SSH. Okay. SSH started bash. Within bash I started ps-tree. That's the command that just executed. That shows you the process hierarchy. This shows the process hierarchy for the entire system. Okay, the parent-child relationship. So the ps-tree is a child of the bash process because I just started ps-tree using bash. Okay, so bash is essentially forked itself and exec on ps-tree.
So it's going to be, if you kill the parent, will it kill all child processes?
Okay. So question, last question, and we'll end here. If you kill a parent, what happens to the child? Okay, typically if you kill a parent, the child becomes what's called an orphaned process. Okay, it doesn't have a parent. Okay, all orphaned process basically have a default parent which is init. Okay, so orphaned processes don't really have a parent, so we'll get a default parent which is init. Okay, but typically you don't have a parent at that point. The system just gives you a default parent. Okay, but a child is not killed just because the parent dies. Okay, so we are going to stop here because 1:15. We'll continue next week. Tomorrow there's a discussion section, okay, which Anthony is going to conduct. It's in the usual classroom.
When you go to the office hours,